So today we're going to look at Mitzvah 21, recounting the Exodus from Egypt in Sefer Chinuch. But before we start, we're going to answer a question that we asked in a previous class.
Okay. I hope I can say this in a decent way. You can see how formal my notes are and everything. Rabbi Nussbaum mentioned that the minhag of the fast of the firstborn, where a girl will participate, they have a siyum type thing, and the girl will participate and by eating a cookie that was at the siyum, that sort of thing. So he mentioned that particular part, but he said that most of his comments to me came from the Chafetz Chaim, who is the creator of the Mishneh Berurah. All right, that in there, he talks about the Midrash Rabbah, that in Parshas Bo, the discussion of Shemot in Parsha Bo, that's what the Chofetz Chaim uses to say that it was the firstborn period, girl or female, right. I mean, that boy or girl that that was taken in that final Makos. And that whole discussion is in there in the third Midrash. And that's where the Chafetz Chaim quotes in the Mishneh Berurah this exact point. But he also brought up the fact that Rashi talked about that because the Egyptian women were not very faithful mates, that they had numerous children that were possibly with different men, which weren't really even known in the family at the time, that the father was not the husband, per se. So the mother could have multiple losses of children because the firstborn was based on the father.
Oh, wow.
At that, you know, with the Egyptians.
Huh.
So there, yeah, a mother could have multiple losses of first children.
So it was both the firstborn boys and girls who were taken.
Well, according to the Chofetz Chaim,
and according to the father, because when we, it's interesting, because when we dedicate the firstborn, it's the firstborn of the mother. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting thought.
It's not
Very interesting.
Right. And the New York Times Magazine this week had a whole article about genetic testing and paternity and how the cheap genetic tests of today are challenging notions of paternity altogether. That now we can find out who's the actual genetic father. And yet, if a man didn't know that earlier and yet raised a child, so felt the connections of paternity to the child, and might even have legal obligations of paternity towards the child, even if he's not the genetic father. So, because there is a common law presumption that if a couple is married, the child it belongs to the father, right, to the husband.
The putative father.
Right, so that father would have legal obligations even if genetic testing proves he's not the actual father. Mm. Even if they get divorced, that he might still have to pay child support.
Because
even if he's not the genetic.
Even if he's not the genetic father and even if you can prove it. So it just talked about the legal complications and the social complications
of
paternity altogether and what our notions of paternity are. And, yeah, so it's interesting just to hear that this is not a new phenomenon, that this so challenging notions of paternity started much earlier, but that this plague actually did confirm who was the father of who.
Yeah. Based upon
who died in the plague.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the wisdom of God, yeah. Right. Okay, so now let's start looking at Mitzvah 21. So we're just going to do two mitzvahs today because the first one is very long and interesting to see inside. So Mitzvah 21, recounting the Exodus from Egypt. So that is the actual mitzvah. This is on page 129, Mitzvah 21. So the mitzvah is based in the verse. So let's just review this blue sheet here that you get. If it's blue every week, I don't know, but often it's blue. The where else, what, to whom, and why that I put there. So that follows the structure And actually, I reversed it's the structure of each mitzvah. The way that it's written here in the Sefer Chinuch is where else, what, why, and to whom. I reversed the to whom and the why because I wanted to leave more notes there for the why, more space for notes for the why. But basically, every mitzvah that he writes follows this structure. Where do you find it in the first place? What's the primary source? What is the verse in the Torah? And so each mitzvah, you'll be able to look inside and see that. Where else is it discussed? So it will either say the tractate in the Talmud or other sources where it's discussed. What is the actual mitzvah? What is the mitzvah and how is it done? That's the what. The to whom is to whom does it apply? And he often says where, to whom and where does it apply? Like sometimes only in the land of Israel, sometimes only in the land of Israel when the temple is standing, sometimes everywhere in all times and all places. And to whom, to males, to females, or to both? To adults, to children, to whoever, to slaves, to, you know, whatever it is. So he'll say, to whom does it apply? And then the why. The why the mitzvah is there in the first place. Or some of the whys, not all of the whys. So that's the structure of how the author of the Sefer Chinuch writes for each mitzvah. So that should just help us follow as we go through to take notes on that if you want to. But just to help us look for these common threads that are in each explanation. So where is this mitzvah found? It's found in the verse where it says, and you shall tell your son on that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. That's in Exodus 13:8. So that's the where this mitzvah is found, recounting the Exodus from Egypt. So this is separate from the mitzvah of remembering the Exodus from Egypt, which I don't know which number of mitzvah that is, but there is a mitzvah of remembering the Exodus from Egypt. And this is the recounting of it. So this is an interesting difference on it. There are six mitzvahs of memory that once you memorize those six, you can run through each day and get six mitzvahs, just, you know, participate in six mitzvahs kind of quickly. So I personally do that because I often don't daven a full shacharis. But if I just buzz through these six, I feel like, okay, I did something in the morning. So remembering the Exodus from Egypt, remembering the traveling through the desert, remembering Amalek, remembering what happened to Miriam, remembering the Sabbath, and remembering, receiving the Torah. Those six things. Those are the six mitzvahs of memory.
Mm-hmm.
Exodus from Egypt. So I usually try to do it in order. I'm working on my Seder, so I'll try to do it in order of when they happen. The Exodus from Egypt, the traveling through the desert, what happened to Miriam, Amalek, receiving the Torah, standing at Har Sinai and receiving the Torah, and the Sabbath. So that's the order. We came out. We walked through. Miriam got leprosy. Amalek attacked us. We got the Torah. And we got the Sabbath.
And just thinking about it fulfills that, the mitzvah?
Yeah. So it's a mitzvah to remember those six things.
Oh, okay.
So mm-hmm,
we just did six mitzvahs. Right. So you could pause for a minute and try to remember each thing. So sometimes I just close my eyes and try to imagine. I just like have this vision of the Jews coming out of Egypt, trekking through the desert, Miriam's hand turning white, you know, her getting the leprosy, the standing at Har Sinai, Amalek attacking us, and then remember the Sabbath and make it holy. So I just have that in mind. I have my visual. So I play my little video in my head, and that's those six mitzvahs. If you look in the back of the Siddur, it has the six mitzvahs listed, and it will have the verses. So some people will read out the verses where they are. So it's the end of Shacharis.
At the very end of Shacharis.
Mm-hmm. After Shacharis. Before. Usually sitters are arranged in the order of the day. So most sitters begin with Shacharis and then are followed by some readings after Shacharis and then followed by a whole section on blessings because that after you daven, you eat and bless. And then Mincha, Maariv, then Shabbos, Maariv, and Shacharis, and Mincha, and then Havdalah, and then, before Maariv, Shabbos, Musaf, and then before Mincha, Shabbos will be Pirkei Avos, because you study Pirkei Avos Shabbos afternoon, and then Shabbos, Mincha, and then Havdalah, and then
Maariv,
right. Well, Maariv is a weekday Maariv, and usually the Zmiros for Shabbos are after Maariv, and also after after Musaf for the evening Zmiros and the daytime Zmiros. So
Kabbalah Shabbat,
right. So it's all in order of the week. And then the last stuff will be like a few extra prayers that you say for Rosh Chodesh, Hallel, Hanukkah lighting, and then some Torah reading, stuff like that. So most sitters are arranged in that way. So at the end of Shacharis, you'll find some extra readings. That's where you find Tefillat HaDerech often, right. And that's where you'll find the Animamins, the 13 principles of faith, and the six things that you're supposed to remember. Sometimes you'll find, but I don't often see, the six constant mitzvahs, but you don't usually see that. That's different than this list of six. And we'll look at that next week, what those six are, because next week is we'll be looking at Parshat Yitro, which has the Ten Commandments in it, the 14 mitzvahs of the Ten Statements. But the six constant mitzvahs are in there. What else is in there? Just all kinds of little readings like that. Okay. So now let's look here. So first of all, there's a very important principle that we'll get to, but first let's look at the why. So the substance of the precept, the second paragraph, the substance of the precept is the one should remember the miracles and the events that occurred for our forefathers in connection with the Exodus from Egypt, and how he, God, blessed be he, took revenge upon them for us. So two different things, remembering the miracles and also the revenge that God took for us on our behalf. So that's why we should do this, and then we'll see a little bit more. So that's a substance, and then the root is different in this particular case. Even when alone, if no others are present, a person is obligated to speak with words of his mouth. So we hear this in the Haggadah, that even if we would be wise, and even if we would be, you know, whatever, and even if we'd be alone, we should still say this. But this last sentence, last half of the sentence of the second paragraph, for by speech the heart is aroused, is a very important principle in Judaism. Speech makes a difference.
Makes us different.
Right. Speech makes us different. It differentiates us, but speech makes a difference. Koach hadibur, the power of speech. So we want to be very careful with our power of speech to not say negative things. And so we have the whole body of guarding our tongue, all those laws of guarding our tongue. But we also have to conversely have places where we need to use our tongue. And this is one of those places where it can't just be thought, it can't just be read, it has to be said out loud, even if you're alone, because speech makes a difference. Speaking awakens the heart. So that's what it, so here it says, for by speech the heart is aroused. In Hebrew, ki v'dibur yit'arer halev. Yit'arer is awakened or aroused. So it's very important to use speech for awakening your heart. So it's interesting in some of the things that that I'm learning in Bridging the Gap, and some of the things that I'm learning in my Chabura on Tuesday with Rabbi Niven, he really talks about verbal introspection and using our mouth and our speech to create memories, to create impressions on ourselves, and to actually speak things out loud, not necessarily talk to yourself. Sometimes you are rehashing to yourself, for yourself, and sometimes you're talking to God, but the actual use of speech and speech out loud is important to get the words out of your mouth. So that creates a convergence of different physical faculties, brain and mouth and wind and neshama, all those things together. It's important to speak. Okay, so at the root of this precept lies what's written about the Passover offering. So we read that before, that it's important to remember the miracles. But it's bigger than that. So it talks about, we don't have to wonder why there are so many do's and so many don'ts connected to this, which we talked about also in mitzvah number 16, how each one of those mitzvahs, the reason why we have so many mitzvahs is because we are shaped according to our behavior. and so speech also is behavior that shapes us. But these are the preeminent foundations and pillars of our faith, the concept of the Exodus from Egypt and the miracles that were part of it. So it's important for us to remember. So now let's look at the top of page 131. You don't have the same pagination, right? But you can turn the page. So it's a few different things here. So it's not just, and we regularly do say, a commemoration for the departure from Egypt, right? Zecher liyetziat Mitzrayim. We say that over and over again in Kiddush and davening and you know, so many different places in our liturgy. We're constantly harping back. And I used to really wonder, like, why do we say this so much? So it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, how come we're not saying, in remembrance of the building of the Holy Temple, in remembrance of the establishment of the Davidic dynasty. I mean, we have a lot of important seminal events in Judaism. Why constantly, 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 and so often, remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt? So it took me a long time to get to a deeper understanding, but really, if I would have read this earlier, it might have helped. Got to look in the right places for the information. So it's a foundation of our faith, a mighty pillar in our Torah. So the concept that the Exodus teaches is not just that an event happened, that one nation left another with great signs and wonders, but that God rules the planet, that God created everything in 7 days. And it can look like, since there are so many different aspects of creation, so many different levels of power, there's sun and there's rain and there's wind and there's birth and there's death and there's all so many different, what could look like so many different forces, that in the pagan world, each one of these forces was ascribed to a separate god. The concept of, one of the concepts of the plagues was to demonstrate the mastery of one god over every level of force. That one God created it all and one God rules it all. Which is why, I mean, if you think about it, it's a conundrum, a philosophic conundrum. Why should the first verse of the Torah say, Bereshit bara Elokim et haShemayim ve'et haaretz? Why should Elokim, which is plural, if our mantra is Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, God is one, why do we have a plural name of God in the first verse of the Torah? In the beginning, the Elohim, plural, created the heavens and the earth, right? It can be very strange, right? Mm-hmm. So Rabbi Rieti talks about that and how that needs to be part of elementary school education. If you could teach that properly right away, you would bypass so many questions for faith that people would have, that what looks like many forces is one force. And so the Torah says it right out. It seems like it's so many different forces, but it's that one, what we perceive as, can perceive as plural forces, because Elohim means God, and Elohim, pronounced properly, means God's small g. So it's spelled the same, right? But when we say Elohim, we mean God, capital G, singular. And when we say Elohim, we mean God's small g, plural. So it can mean God's small g, plural. So then you can wonder, like in the Ten Commandments, where it says, there should not be lo yelecha Elohim acharim lefanai, there shouldn't be other gods before me. You might think, other gods? Wait a second, there's only one God. Where are the other gods? What is that? So, small g, but are there other gods? So it really means forces or powers. So there are forces or powers. God is good at delegating. So delegating to things that God created, but God created a system in which we can err. Because if we choose not to err, then we strengthen our relationship by making a choice not to see the many, but to see the one that's in charge of all. But we don't get any credit for that choice if it's not easy to see the many. Right? So if it looks like there's many, but the Torah teaches that there's one, then it's our choice if we go with the many theory or if we go with the one reality.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
I'm a little confused.
Okay, good.
How do we get from the seeing the many? I guess I that concept is sort of alien to me. Seeing many.
Mm-hmm.
I understand mm-hmm. that before we believed in one God, that people did, you know, believe in many gods. But I don't understand even, you know, reading the Torah, how it's possible to see that there are many. It seems to me that inherent,
from the Torah, you're
yeah,
saying.
That inherent in the concept, there's one.
There is one. From the Torah, you see one. But the Torah was written in a milieu and still in this world
time.
Today. Not just time. So it wasn't just written for that time. It was written for the human mind,
right,
which can see many. The human mind, because we are not one, we have actually a hard time seeing just one. It's actually a trick for human beings to bring themselves to a place of seeing oneness. Now, most of us have been raised in families where that's very clear. So it's not a question for us. And yet, if you look at the rest of the world, all of humanity, why was this message so earth-shattering, so moving, is that the message of the Jews is one. But everybody else believed in many. The Jews were the only ones who believed in one. And still today, right? So the human mind goes, the human mind on its own goes to a concept of many, because that's what a human mind perceives.
Because it's so confusing and there's so many things that are not comprehensible, that it's easier to ascribe events or occurrences or whatever to
many different forces. You definitely see there's a source that's bigger than you, bigger than a human, that's running certain things. So when you see a hurricane, when you see crops grow, when you see fertility, when you see different things, like a seeking mind is going to say, well, there's a lot of different forces at work here, and I can't control them all. I'm not in charge. So anybody who's really looking sees I'm not in charge. But there's a lot of different areas that a human being is not in charge of. So it seems that reality is that in the world without the Torah, the conclusion that most peoples have reached is that there are many powers. Right? I mean, that's the fact.
I hear the word.
It seems it's hard for us to think that way, but if you just look at the reality of cultures around the world and throughout time and even today, cultures that are not touched by Torah or who don't believe in Torah, whether it's the Christian version,
it's all multiplicity.
So all of them, you know, whether they're animists or, I mean, even in Hindu, now that I listened to that book, so I see there is a oneness concept, but a multiplicity concept. And they don't merge it successfully. It's not a one God concept. There's one and there's many.
I hear what you're saying.
Right. So it's interesting that, I mean, it is a unique, singular concept that the Jews brought of one God rules everything. And that was taught to the world through these miracles.
I learned yesterday that as the Jews were leaving Mitzrayim, they had an idol with them.
Oh, yeah. We were reading that, too.
Is that true?
It's very possible. I mean, the Jews were not a finished product as they left. We definitely brought...
But if idol worship was such a horrible thing, why did God...
But they weren't quite there yet.
Right, they weren't quite there yet. And God did knock out 4/5 of them. In the plague of darkness, 4/5 of the Jews died. So you only have the remaining 1/5 of the...
That actually even left. Did the Jews tag along with them?
Yes, and then the heir of Rav. So it's possible that they did. So there were tag-alongs who were bad converts, converts who didn't really fully take it on. They were converts who weren't there for philosophy. They were converts who were there because of that looked like the Jews were the winning team. They wanted to be on the right side.
Right.
So I mean, that's a different reason to convert, and it's not a real reason for conversion, because then when things look weak, and the power of the Jews in history waxes and wanes. So if one is attaching oneself to the Jews during a powerful time for the Jews, but not for philosophic reasons, then what are they going to do when the power of the Jews wanes in history? And we do wax and wane. I mean, we are a moon people that way. We definitely wax and wane regularly. So this was a time of a strong show of strength for the Jews. So many non-Jews attached themselves to the Jewish people. So it's possible that whether it was the Egyptians that came out or we were in bad shape.
But we were, and we also weren't a one God people yet.
We were descendants of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and Yaakov's 12 sons who were all with the program of one godness. Many people floated away during that time in Egypt. Many people, compromised their beliefs, and those who came out were the non-compromisers, and yet even the non-compromisers were compromised.
But they were still affected and impacted.
Yeah, they were.
Product of your environment.
So, yeah. So that's interesting. Let me just hold on to that thought for a second. Let me answer Marla's.
I was just going to say, and there are individuals within the group, each group, that wax and wane as well. So one person holds an idol.
Right.
That's the way it is. But just, in talking about this notion of oneness, it's extremely difficult, I think, because even if you say the words, I believe oneness, or I see oneness, to really see oneness, you have to think that every fabric of everything here is Hashem, and you're Hashem, and I'm Hashem, and I mean, it's all his world,
right.
And it's so overwhelming.
It is. It's very difficult. And to see the negative and the positive.
Exactly.
To know that the child who's killed violently is God's will as much as it is the child who graduates with honors and is able to then create some kind of cure for cancer.
Right. Right.
You know, that they both come from God.
It's not easy. You know? I mean, it is, when you realize it's flowing through this human brain and body and physiology, it's
difficult. Right. But that's why, and let's just tie this together with Ellie's sentence for a minute. So I just got an of course moment in the car listening to Stephen Covey, The Eighth Habit. So he presents a question, which is just, once you hear it, you'll all say, of course, that's the Jewish thought. So, but let me ask the question first. Is nature or nurture the thing that is, you know?
Control.
Right. Which one?
Yes.
Okay, so our answer today is both, right? But the Jewish answer is neither. That the question is asked from an incorrect paradigm. Because the question of nature or nurture is a question of determinism. And we are influenced by both, but it's all free will. All of it. Right?
Yeah, that's so, very good.
Right? I mean, that's an of course thing. That is Jewish philosophy. It's neither nature. We are influenced by both, but determined by neither. Right? That we are determined by our choices. That is who we are. Is the conglomeration of our choices.
It's inward, not outward.
Right, so that is Jewish philosophy, that we are, that's why free will is such an important principle, because nothing determines us. And if you take away determination, a deterministic principle like that, then it changes the legal system as well. That's why we have the Twinkie defense and the ghetto defense and all the defense, road rage and anger and all that stuff is to say, I was out of control. I had no ability to overcome. And then we Jews say, no, you always have ability. You always have ability. You are not determined by anything. I don't care where you were born or what you were taught. Or, right, to whom you were born, what you were taught, the kind of money you have, how hungry you are, it doesn't matter. You have choice. You have free will. And you can choose. So you're definitely influenced. And as we know, we've talked about Rav Dessler's concept of point of choice, right, that we always are choosing at a certain level and behind which we are not choosing and above which we are not choosing either, that our choices are always on our personal battlefront, right? The battle choice is always fought at the front. You don't fight the battle behind the front lines where you've already conquered the territory, and you can't fight the battle in front of the front lines, which you don't have access to. So, but your point of choice is not static. It's dynamic. It always moves according to how successful you are in the battle. Or how unsuccessful, right? So you can move it back, you can move it forward, but you're always fighting in one place. So your initial point of choice in life is determined by nature and nurture together. And then from there, you're launched. It's your life after that, right? So you can never say, oh, I wasn't raised that way. That's why I don't. Sorry, you know, it's completely up to you. And I think that's why our religion, in a way, had to be founded by a convert. Somebody who could say, you know, I was raised in idols. I was raised in a world where we saw multiplicity. I was raised by parents who didn't really give me a head for education. And I chose it. And everyone who comes from me can choose it. So that's why God had to create a world in which we have free will, but in which choice matters. And choice can't matter unless there's choices. And so the world has to look like has to look like God is hidden, has to look like there's a multiplicity of forces, has to be confusing. Negative things have to be attractive. Why do you think cake tastes so good? Sugar tastes so good. So that you can make a choice to eat something healthier. Right? It makes it up to us. But it wouldn't be much of a choice if sugar tasted nasty and liver was always yummy. Now I happen to like liver, but like, but whatever. You can, you know, make your own thing. If healthy things were so yummy that they were irresistible, and nothing's irresistible, right? That's also from determinism. But if healthy things were the yummy things and only, and the non-healthy things were yucky, so there wouldn't be any choice there. So that's not just for food, that's for everything. If what's spiritually healthy for us was only the most fun thing to do, there'd be no choice. Sometimes it's the not so much fun thing to do, so that we can make a choice over where our instincts are taking us and where our brain overrides our instincts.
Who said that point of choice concept?
Point of choice is Rav Dessler, Eliyahu Dessler. point of choice, right. Point of choice, or nekudat ha-bechira. So it's point. Nekuda is a point. It's a period at the end of a sentence also. Nekuda. Point ha-bechira. Bechira is choice. Nekudat ha-bechira. So that is his concept, point of choice. Okay. So that's why there had to be all those miracles. So we did have to, I mean, here we have the human ability to choose one, and yet we see again, it is so difficult for the human mind to come to a place of one that, and this is such an important factor in the world, that God gave humanity a nice boost with these 10 plagues. So the 10 plagues were God's demonstration of control over every aspect of nature, so that Jews and non-Jews saw it. Now, that's why Pharaoh's heart had to be hardened, to maintain his free will, because the demonstration was so clear that he didn't really have free will after he saw it. You know, if it's so clear. So you have to have a little distance for there to be free will. So if you're a smoker in the emphysema ward, visiting your friend who's dying from smoke-induced emphysema, right? So you're not going to light up the minute you walk out the door. An hour later, though, you will. Right? Because you just need that distance. But that minute you are resolving, I am not going to lie in a bed like this. You know, I am quitting. That's it. I'm done. You know, but an hour later already, so you forgot what it's, you know, the intenseness of the experience. So the distance really helps. But in this case, the experience was so intense that Pharaoh was ready to let the Jews go. It had to be out of his own free will, and that's why God had to harden Pharaoh's heart in order to help him maintain free will, so then he could pick which direction he wanted to go. But
and he made a lot of bad choices.
He made a lot of bad choices, no question about it. And that way he could be held accountable for his choices.
And they were subsequently.
Right, and he is. Right.
Yeah, because so, it never says that they took his choice away. Hardening the heart still doesn't take the choice away, because it still goes to the nature-nurture.
Well, so our sages do ask the question, where is his free will if God hardens his heart? Because that is about his feelings. God doesn't usually tamper with your feelings.
If I beat me every day, yeah, I still have a choice whether I beat my kid every day. I may have been taught that. That's the only thing I know.
Right.
So my heart was hardened to kindness and all of that by the actions that were done to me.
Maybe, but I think hardening the heart here is tampering with feelings, and God doesn't usually do that, because we do say that everything is in the hands of God except for the fear of God,
right,
which he puts completely in our hands. Right. So God won't make somebody fear slash awe. Right. It's not just fear, but that have that awe of God. God doesn't give that to people. So, I mean, he could. But he doesn't, because that's the place of relationship. That's up to us to develop. It wouldn't be a relationship. It's like saying, you know, it's like a love potion. If somebody swallows a love potion and then they love you, so it's nice to be loved, but it's not a real love. You know, in a fairy tale, if you get somebody to swallow the love potion, so that's not true love. True love is engendered in the heart of the person from their own free will. That's the kind of love somebody wants, not robotic, I'll follow you anywhere because I drank a potion love. That's not a satisfying love. And so that's why God will never put that fear slash awe of him in our hearts, because he wants real love.
What about the notion that everyone has free will except the leaders of nations?
Oh, good. That's excellent. Good for asking that. So everyone has free will except for the leaders of nations, but even leaders of nations have free will in personal matters, just not in public matters. So in public matters, so it's not up to Obama if he declares nuclear war on the world. That's in God's hands. So it's just not up to him. It's not up to Gorbachev either, or whoever's into Putin right now. Mm-hmm. So whoever's in charge. So that's what's not up to them. Whether they declare war or not, whether they unleash horrible forces in the world or good forces in the world, that's not up to them, because that changes the course of history. So God runs a general course of history, makes the sweep of history according to his desire. Our free will is within that sweep of history. But there are individuals on the planet who control the course of history. Those are the leaders of the world. So for those leaders of the world, that 100 people or whatever it is, probably really 20 people today, who really are the the ones who affect the whole sweep of history of the whole world, they do not have free will in affecting the sweep of history. So, but they do have free will if they yell at their wife or not,
right,
or if they steal or not,
right,
or how they raise their children, or how they relate to God. Mm-hmm. That free will has not been taken away from them. Mm-hmm. That's totally up to them. But the big things that affect the sweep of history, they do not have total free will over. So when they press that button, it's because God said, we need this now. So, yeah, so that's a hard thing. I mean, and so, I mean, an easier way to see that, or another, a parallel way to see that, is, for instance, global warming, right? Whether or not we believe, so let's just assume that it is caused by humans, okay, and that for the sake of this discussion, whether or not it is. But assuming that it is, and assuming that each one of us could make a difference, right, in it, and if we all would work together, we would change the course of world history. So, assuming that's all true, should we be worried about global warming? Well, so in my opinion, God runs the world. He will decide. Does that mean whether whatever his choice is, if the world is going to melt down or if the world's going to be perfect, it's completely up to him. But given the information that we have today, I believe it is incumbent upon us to recycle and be careful with the use of gas and water and things like that.
That doesn't seem like an inconsistent.
It's not an inconsistent, right. So God runs the world. So what I'm saying is my behavior may not have an effect. That's what I'm saying.
It may not change
anything. It may not change the end result. And yet it is my job to be responsible because the sweep of history is determined by God. Right? Whether there's going to be global warming or not is completely up to God. So it doesn't actually matter if I use up fossil fuel faster than my neighbor or not. And yet, so it doesn't matter in terms of global warming because God decides. But it does matter in terms of my responsibility and my personal development. It is incumbent upon me to live responsibly with the information that I have. So in today's scientific environment, with what we know, it is my responsibility to be careful, to reduce, reuse, recycle, you know, to do those things, to be responsible with the resources on our planet.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit analogous to, we all know we're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a foregone conclusion.
Right.
We will die.
Right.
So does that mean that we don't have to take care of ourselves and
absolutely,
you know, I mean, it's
right.
Right, exactly, but it's the same. But it's the same.
Right, we're not preventing death.
We are engaging and controlling the way in which we live.
Well, so right, so it's a little different then. So yes, health affects and controls, but let's say it doesn't. We're still responsible to eat healthfully,
right,
even if it won't affect and control how we live and how we die, because of the personal choice to engage in best practices. So as Jews, we are required to, as people, we are required to engage in best practices to the best of what we understand best practices to be. Because we need to be responsible, independent of the results. That's what I'm saying. Independent of the results altogether, there is still an obligation to behave responsibly. So, and that's a separate thing. Results are in God's hands, but process is in ours. So we have to engage in the process. And that ties into the Pirkei Avos, Lo Alecha Hamlacha Ligmor, Velo Ata Ben Charin Lehibatel Mimena. It's not up to you to finish the job,
right,
but you cannot desist from trying. So whether or not the job even can be finished is not up to you.
Right.
But trying is. And that's your responsibility. That's our responsibility. Okay, so that's some free will stuff, but let's look at this verse still. So so it's interesting that even in these times there were people, and I think this is Aristotelian, that's why it's talking about it. It's not from an atheistic point of view. People who deny the creation of the world out of non-existence. So it says in this last paragraph that these miracles must silence everyone who denies the creation of the world out of non-existence and must permanently affirm human faith in the knowledge of the eternal Lord and the faith that his watchful control and power extend to all groups and individuals. So that's an important concept because there were faith systems and our faith systems, not even atheists, skipping that whole thing because there weren't atheists at this time. At this time in history, everybody believed something. Everybody believed in some higher power, basically. But there was a very strong stream of thought that the world always existed, that matter was always there, that God was always there, and that God arranged things within what could be arranged from things that already existed, but not that God created everything from scratch. So here, the Jewish concept is God created everything out of nothing, creation ex nihilo, that God created everything from scratch, and therefore what he created is the best possible, not the best out of what was there, but the absolute best. And that if God created everything, God is in charge of everything and runs everything in every direction at all times.
So he created the flower to make the cake.
Right, he created everything.
Take the flower and make the cake.
Right, like right, that's right, right. So he created everything. So, most of us
would bake anyway.
Right. So it's not that the world is static according to the Aristotelian view, but that the world is that there was a beginning point in time, and this is what was so hard about the Big Bang theory altogether, was that there was a beginning point that was hard for scientists to agree with 50 years ago. There was a lot of controversy over a Big Bang when there was proof that there was that the world is expanding, which proved that there was a beginning. This was very controversial because there was a very strong theory that the world always existed. So these signs and wonders proved that. Now, we can ask today. We weren't there. We didn't see it. We don't know anybody who knew anybody who knew anybody who knew anybody who saw it, right? So you're probably the only one in the room who comes from an unbroken chain of transmission. And still, you don't really know. It's written in the Torah. So if we know the Torah is true, then we know it. But how can we know today? Where are the signs and wonders and miracles today that we could see? Let me ask you that question. Where are they today? That's not today.
But it was transmitted to us.
It's transmitted, but where are they today? Where are the signs? A lot of people will say, well, if I would see the parting of the Red Sea, so then I'd believe too. But where is that?
Isn't just the way the universe moves? And
okay, so science is fascinating. And yet we believe in science. It's
planets.
Interesting because the word for nature and the word for Hashem, Elohim and Hateva, has the same gematria. So that is a confusing thing. God set it up so that we could say that's nature. That's the way it works. Of course, when you drop something, it falls. It's the law of gravity. It's an immutable law of the universe. It's nature. It's not that God took that pen out of your hand and made it hit the ground. It's that gravity, which is already there, you have no control over, just makes it drop. Right? So nature could look like, I mean, you can easily, and you know plenty of scientists, right, or people who believe in science who say, no, that's just the way it is. God doesn't run the world. It's not a proof of it.
Right.
Now, there are scientists who every time they discover something say, wow, look at these wonders of Hashem. It's so amazing, right? The more they see, the more amazed they are. But that isn't really the answer of where do we see miracles today that are as miraculous as these that clearly show that God runs the world, that are outside. A miracle has to be something outside of nature.
I think the fact that Israel still exists is pretty miraculous.
There you go. That's it.
Think that, you know, every day.
You hit the nail on the head. It's not just Israel, it's the Jews.
And the Jews. The Jewish
that the Jewish people should
exist.
Still exist today
after what we have been through.
Defies every scrap of nature and science.
The same number, basically, that there always
right.
has been.
Right. It defies everything. That we still exist today. It makes no sense. Scattered throughout the world. And treated the way that we were treated, and killed the way that we were killed.
We're right?
And that we had the Torah, and that you can recognize a Jew from India is the same as a Jew from Madagascar, is the same as a Jew from Brooklyn, is the same as a Jew from Morocco. You walk into any religious home on a Friday night, and there's candles, and challah, and kiddush, and maybe the food will be different in the meal, but the benching is the same. And it's the same. Every single Jew, every Shabbos, all the world around, every synagogue service. Okay, so there's a few different words here and there if it's Ashkenaz or Sephardic, but it is the same world around. We are that people. There's no question that we, sitting here today, are the same people that came out of Egypt. Just no question at all. So that's miraculous. That's such a huge miracle. Right, right. So you can't prove that, but you can prove. Right. No, but I'm saying, what can you prove? What can you point to that you can show is a miracle, meaning something above and beyond nature that makes no sense at all, that clearly shows a divine revelation, a revelation of divine energy in history. And that is the existence of Jews today. Not just that we're the genetic descendants, but that we do the same stuff.
And the non-existence of most of the people who
right.
have been
after. Right, so in contrast to everybody else. Right,
the,
right.
All the people that were there at the beginning.
Right, so we see nature. We see a nature, the way it works, the way, you know, the natural order of the rise and the fall of nations we see around us. Right, and some last a little longer and some last a little shorter, but we see rise and fall of every empire throughout history. But the Jews are just chugging along throughout the whole thing. No matter where we go, no matter what happens to us, we are still there. We're still the Jews. You could recognize us. You can point to us anywhere in the world and say, that's a child of the people who came out of Egypt. We are clearly recognizable. Now, you can't say that about the Spartans. You know, in an elementary school in Brooklyn, you can't say that's a grandchild of the Spartans. But you can say that's a grandchild of the 12 tribes. You could say that today. That is a total miracle, you know, that we're still there.
That was really God's plan in spreading us throughout the diaspora.
That is one of the parts of the plan, clearly.
No one group could get us
right.
in one place.
Right, so no one group could get us, and so that we affect the nations that we touch, mm-hmm. and that we redeem, and that we redeem the sparks of holiness that are in the nations that we pass through. There are converts that need to be gathered in each nation, and there are concepts that need to be gathered, little pieces, sparks of holiness around that need to be brought into one big mass of holiness and redemption for the world. And so the Jews being scattered both protected the Jews and tried the Jews and put us in places where we could affect the world and put the sparks of holiness in contact with Jews so that could be brought back in. So many different aspects of it. But yeah,
again, no accident.
Not at all. I mean, it's just a total, the whole thing is a total miracle. That, I mean, and if you look at it clearly, you see it absolutely transcends nature. You know, not to mention just the last 60 years of the existence of the State of Israel. Right. It coming into existence and its existence continuing until today. Although today we're a little more worried than we have been in the recent past. But still, we definitely see miracles. There's just no question about it. I mean, if you want to see miracles, you look at the Jewish people and you see miracles. So that is why we have this this mitzvah to commemorate the exodus from Egypt, the concept that God runs the world, the miracles that he effected on our behalf, just to show us that he runs everything and still runs everything. Uh-oh. And I wanted to go through the whole Haggadah. It's really interesting.
Well, yeah. What's interesting is that there's only one Kiddush in his recounting.
And there's lots of hand washings.
Lots of hand washings.
Lots of hand washings and only one real Kiddush.
Well, you only make one pre-Hagafen or one Kiddush? Because there is only one Kiddush. But it's interesting that his Seder, so this will just be interesting to read if anybody wants on their own because we're close to the end of time here. Just to read that the order was in principle the same, but had a lot of extra hand washings and a few. It's definitely different than the way we do it today. And so the notes on the side, the English notes, will help you see some of the differences. And even here it says that it's praiseworthy to drink a fifth cup.
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Right? But the notes, because we do pour a fifth cup, but we don't drink it. That's the cup of Eliyahu, pouring the fifth but not drinking the fifth. So it says that it may be praiseworthy to drink the fifth, but then it says that in the Shulchan Aruch, that we don't. It's something that's forbidden to drink the fifth.
But obviously at this time.
So at that time, that wasn't clear yet, that it's forbidden to drink the fifth, that some people would hold that it's praiseworthy. So it's interesting just for this to get a snapshot of Judaism at the time. So yes, while you can point to the Jew and say they are the same, they do the same rituals, there are little bits and pieces that are different. But we still all have a Seder today, whether we wash our hands this many times or not. We still all are drinking 4 cups of wine. We still are all telling the story. We still are all eating matzah. We still are all finishing the meal with matzah and not following it up with anything except for the wine. So the skeleton remains the same, and the little flourishes around the edges sometimes change. But the basic law is the same. So that's that one. Should we do this next one, or we could do it pretty fast? The reason why I put this next one together, we're going to do it just because I've got to make a little more progress in this. Okay, so that's the end of Parshat Bo. So the beginning of and the only mitzvah in Parshat B'Shalach is the mitzvah of not going beyond the permitted limits on the Sabbath. Now, this is interesting because it actually recalls the same concept that God runs the world. He established the world, he created the world, and since he created it, we have to live in a way that shows that he created it. So really, the exodus from Egypt and the creation of the world, Shabbos, the commemoration of the creation of the world, are very connected. So this is on page 137. You have to skip a little bit, mitzvah number 24. So the root is the same, that God runs the world. But what's interesting about this one, particularly, that I just wanted to point out here, this is how far you are permitted to walk on the Sabbath, past the limits of the city. And it doesn't matter how big the city is. It says even if the city is as big as Nineveh, and we know from reading the book of Jonah that Nineveh was a big enough city that it took 3 days to walk across, so it was the size of Denver or bigger. It was big. We're a very big city. It doesn't matter if it's a little hamlet or a huge city. You measure from the last house. And that's how far you're permitted to walk outside the city. So it's saying at the root of this precept is that God created the world in 6 days and he rested on the seventh. This is the only place where you see rest, really, as a concept. Because all the other halachas of Shabbos, I think all the other ones, the bulk of them, is about not doing the creative work, right? Not engaging in melacha, which we often mistranslate as work. But it's the 39 types of work that you're not permitted to engage in on the Sabbath are 39 types of creative effort. But this one of not walking that far is because God rested. So you're not permitted to exert yourself. So where you are permitted to move all the furniture out of your living room, even schlep couches and things downstairs to the basement, if Shabbos afternoon you're hosting a gathering that's too large for furniture to be in your living room, and that's exertion, you're permitted to exert yourself. But not this much. You're not permitted to walk that far out of the city. There is a limit because of the rest concept. Because this is not a creative energy thing. This is rest. So
you can take a little spatzir.
You can take a spatzir, but you can't, yeah, go on a hike. So spatzir is okay. So, and that's what it says here. The same as the other one at the root of this precept on page 139, second paragraph. Lies the aim that we should remember and know that the world was engendered out of non-existence and was not pre-existent, as is written explicitly about the mitzvah of the Sabbath. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, in remembrance of this, it is fitting that we should rest in one place, which means we should not go on any lengthy journey, but only walk for strolling and pleasure. And in walking 12 mils, there is no great exertion. Because it does talk about how far. And then, so further on in Eruvin, so that's the where, is that verse. And the where else, no, the where, that's the root of the precept. The where is Exodus 16:29, where it says, let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. The where else is in Tractate Eruvin, where it discusses all the things that go along with it. What if somebody's in a cave? What if somebody's beyond the limit of his own free will or being compelled? Or what if somebody has permission of the Beit Din to walk further? That would be, for instance, in examples of declaring the new moon on the Sabbath. You are permitted to walk beyond this distance. What if a house is further out than the other house of the city by slightly more than 70 cubits? What if there's a synagogue that contains a dwelling? So is that like a house or not a house? What if it's an idol worship place that contains a dwelling? Is that a house or not a house? Right, so all these different things. It's interesting, number 10 says, what if a city is shaped like the Greek letter gamma, right, which is a bow? What if it's shaped like that? Then how does that make a difference? So all these things about what if, that's all discussed in Eruvin to understand exactly how to keep this law. But the root of the law is that we should rest on the Sabbath like God did. So, and the root of that is that God created the world and he runs it and we have to listen.
Replace every time.
Right.
Man and woman.
That's right. And it applies to everybody and every time. That's correct. There does seem to be a little argument at the end of this, which we can't go into, and that's good because I don't really understand it. So, and there is a little argument at the end. So maybe I'll call Robin Nussbaum and ask him about that. And that's it for today.
Yes,
God runs the world. Okay.